On the Bechdel cast, the questions asked if movies have women in them. Are all their discussions just boyfriends and husbands, or do they have individualism? The patriarchy's effing vast. Start changing it with the Bechdel cast.
The time has come, the woman said to the other woman, to talk of many things, of shoes and ships and sealing wax, of cabbages and queens.
Wow, Caitlin.
And why the sea is boiling hot, and whether pigs have jeans to rhyme with queens.
Jeans. Oh, I was like, is that a feminist thing? Jeans instead of wings? Seems more restrictive than wings.
Just needed to. That's true. And that's, you know, that's my bad.
Jeans are a prison for all genders. and so in that way, it's a very inclusive piece of restrictive clothing.
Right. That's true.
In conclusion, I liked your poem.
Thank you so much. Yeah. It is from today's movie. But before we get there, hello and welcome to the Bechdel cast. My name is Caitlin Durante.
My name is Jamie Loftus.
And this is our feminist movie podcast where we examine the representation of women in film. And we use something called the Bechdel test. Jamie, what is that even?
Well, I think I remember. Here's what, if memory serves, here's what it is. The Bechdel test is a media metric invented by cartoonist Alison Bechdel, sometimes called the Bechdel-Wallace test, that requires a piece of media do the following. There has to be two female identifying characters with names for our purposes who speak to each other about something other than a man for two lines of dialogue or more. Most movies can't make it happen. Absolutely can't.
Whiz.
I just watched that new movie with Chris Hemsworth on Netflix, and I have to say, it doesn't pass anything. It doesn't pass the good movie test. It doesn't pass the Bechdel test. It doesn't pass the I finished the movie test. A lot of movies don't pass it.
Which one's that? Extraction?
Extraction.
More like I want to extract myself out of this movie watching experience.
Swish. Oh. Love it.
I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, don't bother.
But today's movie, I feel like today's movie will do okay on the Bechdel test, not to spoil.
It would be, imagine how deeply gut-wrenchingly disappointing it would be if this movie somehow did not pass the Bechdel test.
Right?
It would be devastating.
Well, we're covering Harriet the Spy. Yeah. And before we even introduce our guest, who we are very excited to have on the show, we wanted to jump to a quick conversation that we had with friend of the show. She played Janie in the movie Harriet the Spy. It's Vanessa Lee Chester.
Hi, Vanessa. Welcome back.
Hi, I'm so excited to be back. I honestly, when I got Caitlin's email, I was like, what is going on? Because I had just been thinking about you guys. And I was like, you posted something on Instagram. And I was like, she's so fucking funny. And I literally was like, I had such a great time chatting with you guys. And all my friends who like listened to the episode were like, this is such a fucking legit show. And I was like, I know, right? And so when you guys hit me up, I was like, they like me.
We love you. Welcome back.
I'm excited. Yes.
So we're covering Harriet the Spy, and I guess we just like wanted to start by talking to you about like your experience on that movie. How do you remember that time and that shooting experience now?
It was fantastic. Like, I can't speak for a lot of other child actors, but I loved being on that set so much. I feel like of all the characters that I've ever played, I feel like the most similar to Janie. Like, she's weird. She's very expressive in the way that she dresses, and that denotes so much of her character. She's passionate about science, which is something that you don't see a lot in young women. And I'm obsessed. I swear that Bill Nye is my friend, but we've never met. And it was just like, in my mind, like, Neil deGrasse Tyson is my uncle, and then his best friend is Bill Nye, and we're just all this huge, great family. But yeah, like, working on that set was just so fantastic. I feel like the story is just, it's like everything a precocious, curious kid wants to live out, and then getting a chance to actually bring it to the big screen was such an honor. Like, I loved every moment of it.
Oh, that's the best. That's,
yeah, I'm still friends with everyone. Like, Greg and I talk.
Really?
Yes. Oh. Greg is like my boy. Like, he will have a special place in my heart for the rest of my life.
Oh, aww. That's the best.
Yeah.
And then so now, years later, what for you or just based on, you know, because I'm sure that people talk to you about it a fair amount. What is the legacy of this movie sort of like become over time?
I feel like that's a really difficult question because I feel like there's something really special about this movie, but it resonates in different ways for everyone. I got a really sweet DM, I want to say, at the end of last year from this lady on Instagram, and I'm only saying her race because it's relative to this, it's important to the story, and mm-hmm. she happens to be white, and she was like, hey, you know, I just wanted to reach out to you and see if there was any way you could possibly send me an autograph for my sister. She's adopted and she happens to be black. And we used to watch Harriet the Spy all the time when we were little because we were like, Janie and Harriet are basically sisters. And we looked at it like us, like two little girls who are, you know, outcasts, but are completely grounded in who they are. And I was like crying reading the DM, you know. Aww. and I sent her like, I sent her an autographed copy of my DVD and like a poster, and I was like, this is for you, your sister, and your brother, because like you guys are basically Janie, Harriet, and Sport.
Mm-hmm. That's the best.
Yeah, it was really sweet. Gosh. Like, we're friends on LinkedIn now. Which is so random. I'm like, do you think I actually have like a dope job? I'm an actor trying to like be on more movies. It always surprises me when I hear from fans of Harriet the Spy and just how it resonated for them. And I feel like a lot of girls who I've heard some women from the LGBTQ community say that like I kind of felt like Harriet may have been like the first lesbian that I read about, you know. And I was like, whoa, that's something that I've never thought about. And I just think that that's cool that, like, it's almost up for interpretation. But you can see yourself in it regardless.
For sure.
That's the best. I love it.
A quick question I had, because neither Jamie nor I have read the book that the film was based on. And we were trying in our research to figure out if the Janie character was specifically written as black, and we couldn't find anything out about that. So we were wondering if you knew about that, or if maybe the character was just written kind of ethnically ambiguous and they cast.
It's really interesting that you brought that up. I'm glad that you said that because I was going to bring it up myself. Once you guys asked me to do this, I picked the book back up and I was like, I need to like refresh myself and see what this is about. And in, I want to say the second chapter, when Harriet is going back to school, they're describing all of the kids and they describe Janie and they're like, Janie is a shy, meek girl with freckles and like doesn't really like making eye contact with people. And I was like, whoa. I mean, freckles could be any race, but they're generally, you know, associated with people who happen to be Caucasian. And I was like, whoa, you know, and it kind of made me think like, I feel like Janie might have been white, but the director didn't want that. And I remember auditioning and they were like, we want you to be bold and we want you to be like charismatic and have a lot of confidence. And like, I loved it. I was like, she's wild. Like, this is the version of me that I wish I could bring to school every day. But yeah. It seems as if Janie in the book is actually a little bit more questions herself a little bit, which I thought was an interesting adaptation.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Janie in the movie definitely feels like an aspirational like character. Like you want to be like her.
Oh my gosh. I remember like I knew I was getting paid, but I didn't really care. I was like, but how can I have Janie's entire wardrobe? That's what we really need to talk about. Like, I get it. Like, I'm going to go to college with this money that I'm allegedly making. But what about those suspenders that you guys made? I want those.
Did you get to keep anything?
I don't remember, to be honest. I'm sure I did. And who knows?
Oh, God. Justice for the overalls.
Gotta find them. They're like in some type of like It's a Wrap type of thrift store in Burbank, and I just gotta find them.
Right. Do you have any other kind of final thoughts that you want to share, or any thoughts at all about your experience being in the movie or just with the story itself or anything along those lines?
Well, now that we're chatting, I'm really excited to revisit the book and just read it now that I'm older and like have a different type of analytical eye. Because, you know, when I was younger, I remember starting the book and just dropping it because I was like, oh, like, I don't even want to read the rest. I just want to get a notebook. And I thought it was really funny because I was actually in the movie. I had just finished shooting it and I went back to school with a notebook. And I think it's really funny as an adult looking back on how even though I knew that I had filmed this entire spectacular movie, like my imagination was so sparked by what she was doing. All I wanted to do was like run on roofs and spy on people. And my mom was like, don't try that shit. Do not even try it.
Right.
Like I went to school with a notebook, like basically pretending I was Harriet before the movie came out.
That's amazing. I had the same experience where I saw the movie as a young child and was obsessed with Harriet and her notebook and her spy gear. And I just like wanted to be Harriet. Yeah.
And that's what's so amazing about it. Like we all wanted to be Harriet, you know, like it just, there was something so courageous about her. Like that's what we all want to do is like pretend we're older. And like, that's the thing that I find to be very endearing about Harriet is a lot of young kids, we all feel like we're adults. Like, I remember telling my mom I could run the country at 10. Like, I was confident that I would be a better president than all the people that I saw on TV. And maybe I was right.
I mean, are you wrong?
I know. I was like, you're right. Still out. Who knows? Like, I was a pretty woke little 9-year-old, whatever. But it's amazing how mature Harriet is. And like, in the book, they denote the parts that are specifically her writing in her notebook with a different font, so you know that those are her thoughts. And there's a part in the book where Olgali says to her, like, you need to write down everything. You don't need to, like, sugarcoat it. Write down things in the way that you see it, you know? And as you guys remember the movie, like, her friends see the notebook and everyone loses it. And I'm like, when I was little, I used to be like, oh my God, Harriet's so mean. She's so messed up. But like now that I'm older, I'm like, she's a child and children are amazing because they're so honest. Like she wasn't actually trying to be malicious. She was just documenting and writing down what she saw without trying to impress anyone because she didn't feel like her thoughts would be out in the public, you know? I don't know. It's just a thought that I had.
No, totally. I have the same feeling. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, he's like, Janie's weird and might blow up the world. Yeah, if you had a friend who was like always talking about blowing up the world at 10, you might be a little skeptical.
A little nervous. That's, I mean, that's like part of what I really love about the movie, like, is that it makes like friendships with kids, like it takes their friendships seriously and they're like complicated, but they're also like, yeah, of course a kid would say that if they, or I mean, anyone would say that if they didn't think it, anyone else would ever see it. So you can like feel for her, but also be like, you can't do Janie like that.
I mean, that's a really great point is like, it definitely brings like a drama that's like, that's their world. And, you know, we're sitting here and we're like, you're in sixth grade, it'll be fine. But like, sixth grade is everything when you're in sixth grade.
Right.
So, yeah, I love that point, Jamie. That's really legit.
Well, Vanessa, thank you so much for contributing, for giving your amazing thoughts and firsthand experience of being in the movie.
And thank you for being in the movie. It's the best.
Yes.
You guys are so amazing. Thank you so much for inviting me back. This has been such a great little piece of joy during what we're all going through, being able to discuss one of the projects that I've been in that I absolutely adored being a part of. And I cannot wait to hear this episode and how you guys break it down because you guys kill it. And I know you're going to do it justice.
Yay. Yes. Thank you again. And we'll have to have you back again for like a legitimate episode, like a full episode.
Yeah. Like don't play me. I will stalk you if you don't invite me back. So just know that it's all on, we've got it documented.
We accept the challenge.
Love it. All right. You guys are awesome.
You too.
Talk to you soon.
Thank you so much. Have a good day.
Yay. Thanks again, Vanessa, for chatting with us. And that brings us to our wonderful guest for today's episode. She is a podcast host, a producer, an actress, best known from Glee. It's Jenna Ushkowitz. Hello.
What's going on, you guys? I'm so excited to be here.
Oh, we're so excited to have you.
Love a good quarantine record.
Oh, you know it. You know it. Oh, yeah. It's a good time to watch lots and lots of movies.
It's true.
Yes.
It's full on escape zone. I love it.
Right. Right.
Tell us about your relationship and your history with Harriet the Spy.
Well, I loved Harriet the Spy. This is totally, like, we're similar in age, Michelle Trachtenberg and I. And when this came out, I was like, finally, a girl who can wear jeans and sneakers and doesn't have to wear dresses all the time. And, like, somebody who kind of, like, is wearing what I would want to wear. That's the first thought I had when I saw Harriet. Yeah. The really cool little yellow raincoat. And I started acting when I was really, really young. And I would do voiceovers a lot. And I got a call to do some looping, which is the background voices throughout the film that they need to fill in, like, a playground or at school or whatever. And so I went in to do looping for Harriet the Spy. So in some of these scenes, I'm actually, like, whispering, like, especially in the Carrie, like, blue paint scene.
Yeah.
I whispered, like, into the girl's ear. And
that's
it was
so cool.
Oh my gosh, your voice.
And so I still get these, like, mini checks from Paramount for 10 cents from Harriet the Spy. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, every once in a while, it'll be like 60 cents. You're like, we're going out. And Michelle and I actually modeled together a lot growing up. We were you know, we kind of, like, crossed paths a lot in the business. So
nice.
But I love the film. And I actually also loved it so much that I got a marble notebook and I, you know, duplicated the private on it. And I wrote all these, like, crazy things about my family in them. And one day I walk in my room, my mom's like, what is this? She's like, what did you write? And she's like, this movie is no good for you. And it was like all made up stuff. But she was like, I was like, you're reading my diary.
Parents have an interesting relationship with this movie because they're like, that's such an amazing connection to this movie. That's so cool.
Your voice has a presence,
a life in the movie.
Yes.
Yeah, I very vividly remember standing in, like, this big voiceover room and, like, booth. It was a really big booth though, and the movie was, like, on this massive screen on the wall, and they would just start, and then you would, you know, have to play and, like, be in a playground with, like, other kids. It was, like, the most fun.
That's so cool.
Oh, that's so fun. Yeah. Jamie, what's your relationship with the movie?
I have a very complicated relationship with this movie in that I was like 3 or 4 when this movie came out, so I didn't see it when it first came out, but I wasn't allowed to watch it when I was little because I was like a full on, like, undiagnosed OCD child. And so I took a notebook literally everywhere, and I would get in trouble at school about it because I did this thing from, I first remember doing it in first grade, but I had this, like, real child OCD fixation on writing down what everyone in a room was wearing and saying for no reason. Like, it was unlike Harriet. I had no end game. There was no objective or career goal attached to my notebooks, but I just did it compulsively, and I would get in trouble for it all the time. And people were like, this makes me uncomfortable. Why does she keep writing down that I'm wearing a yellow shirt? And so it was, like, such a chronicled problem for me that my mom was like, movie about girl with notebook, we can't have it in the house. Like, so I didn't get to see it. And I'm so bummed because now that I've seen it, I'm like, first of all, my mom was kind of right. And it definitely would have made my notebook problem a million times worse. And it was already pretty bad. But second of all, it's such a good movie. And it's so, like, I don't know. I just, like, I love it in every single way. I love movies that let kids be, like, complicated and kind of messy, but not fall into that, like, precocious child trope that is so annoying. And I don't know. I just think it's so well done. I love, like, the direction style of it. It seems like everyone in the movie is, like, having the time of their life. And oh, I just wish I could have seen it when I was younger, but I'll hand it to Jill. She was probably right not to show it to me.
Jill being a good parent.
Yeah. Well, she's just like, I don't want my kid to get bullied at school for her horse notebooks any more than she already is. What's your experience with this movie, Caitlin?
I did watch it when I was a youth. I was deeply impacted by this movie. Mm-hmm. But what I remember way more than the movie itself was what I did in response to the movie. Like, I think I probably mm-hmm. saw it maybe only once or twice. It came out in 96. I was 10. So I was like kind of the exact right age for it.
Yeah.
But I think I saw it few enough times that I don't remember what the story was at all. But again, it impacted me so much that the movie made me want to be a spy. I had my mom get me a notebook just like Harriet's, one of those like marble notebooks. Mm-hmm. I put together this little like kit of spy stuff, anything I could get my hands on, which was mostly just like a magnifying glass and like a pen. But I was like, I'm going to be a spy.
Yeah.
And I started eating mayonnaise sandwiches because I didn't like tomato, but so I didn't want to eat the tomato part of the tomato and mayonnaise sandwiches that Harriet makes, but I liked mayonnaise, so I would just eat just plain mayonnaise sandwiches. I would do this thing where I would slurp soup very obnoxiously and then say good soup like Harriet does in the movie. Like I picked up all these habits from the movie, but rewatching it to prep for this episode, I realized that I had no idea what this movie was about. I like had completely forgotten everything about the story. But again, it really had a major impact on me when I was a child. So,
oh, that's so, it's iconic.
It really is. It had such a, like, it's so interesting. It had such an effect, even though you didn't even get to see it. Like, it was really impactful and like finally seeing a girl who's not so dainty and like wanting to have a notebook to write things down. Like, I think it was impactful in like a positive way, even though parents probably had a very torrid relationship with the film for their children. But I feel the same way. I definitely made those sandwiches and I definitely like, I felt very like, I just wanted to be her. I wanted to replicate her. I wanted to be her. She made it really cool. Like she was really cool.
Totally.
I feel like, this movie is good representation for people who double down on disgusting sandwiches. And I include myself in that community. If someone's like, this is the worst food you could possibly eat every single day. And I'm doing it proudly. You're like, all right.
I mean, it also just speaks to, and I'm sure we'll talk about this a lot, but it just speaks for the need for representation of movies about little girls like doing cool things and doing things that like other little girls or little children as viewers can aspire to, because there just isn't much of that still. And the fact that this movie exists and was so impactful for so many people just like speaks to that need. Yeah.
And just being like reflective of what a sixth grader's interests actually are. Cause I feel like movies for like targeted at young girls and sometimes young boys as well is like 11-year-olds that are like, there's a crush narrative that takes up a ton of real estate that like, I don't know. There's so many like, sixth graders are weird and their interests are weird and their friendships are like intense. And I like that this movie kind of reflects all of that.
For sure. Well, should we talk about the story and then go from there?
I say yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Couldn't hurt.
Okay. So we meet Harriet. That's Michelle Trachtenberg, of course. She is a young girl who wants to be a writer. She learns everything she can and she writes down everything she sees in this private notebook that she always carries around. And that's why she's a spy. She's a spy because she's gearing up for a career as a writer. We cut to her at school. She and her best friends sport Gregory Smith and Janie, of course, played by Vanessa Chester, who you just heard. They are in sixth grade, and Harriet is nominated for class president, along with her arch nemesis, Marion Hawthorne. And the best perk of being class president is being editor of the sixth grade newspaper.
Which is a weird thing. I was like, wow, what a strange two powers to connect.
Right.
Seems like the president shouldn't edit the newspaper.
Yeah, that would be like if Donald Trump was like the head of all news right now.
I mean, he's the head of some news.
Right.
Yeah.
All that to say, it seemed like a conflict of interest to me.
I agree. Also, I don't know about like your schools, but like we didn't have a sixth grade newspaper. There was no journalism of any kind is for me
until like high school.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Okay. It was like high school is when school newspaper hits.
Right. Okay. Just yeah. just making sure.
Yeah. Before that, it's just all you just trust what you hear over the loudspeaker.
And if that isn't a totalitarian regime.
Exactly.
I was very envious of those classes where you'd see like they have the morning news where you got to be like a newscaster. Because
yeah.
I would have totally been that girl. But like we didn't have that.
Yeah, I didn't have that.
No. We had like a teenager that went to the principal's office to do the announcements every day so the principal wouldn't have to. We just had the principal outsourcing their job to children.
Wow.
Wow.
Rude.
Yeah.
Well, unfortunately for Harriet, Marion, her enemy, wins class president. Then after school, Harriet goes off on her spy route. She spies on this guy who has a bunch of cats, dozens of cats. And now's a great time to mention Cat Facts with Caitlin. Cats have 8 nipples, and there were many cats. I don't know how many cat nipples there were, but there's a lot. Anyway,
I was counting my cat's nipples the other day, and I couldn't get to 8.
Some of them don't have that many.
Couldn't make 8 happen.
My fact is actually not a fact.
Then why are you spreading
fake
facts?
Well, because that's what Google told me the one time I looked it up.
Fake news.
Yep. Cancel me.
Cat facts is fake news.
Anyway, okay, so... Harriet's on her spy route. She's looking at the guy with a bunch of cats. Then she spies on the Hong Fat family at their supermarket. She spies on the delivery guy who she thinks is stealing vegetables. And then she's writing all of this down in her notebook. Then we meet Harriet's nanny, Golly, played by Rosie O'Donnell. She is a very important figure and mentor in Harriet's life.
She's like... She's a better parent than Harriet's parents.
Right. Who are these kind of upper crust, don't seem to spend a lot of time with Harriet. I think her dad is like a comedy screenwriter or something. There's that exchange of dialogue where he's like, I'm the funny man. I do the comedy. The other guys are the money men. And
I like to think this is commentary on how most male comedy writers are actually very uptight and not funny at all.
Yes. Agree.
Yeah.
What an interesting choice of job for this upper crust family.
Right.
Yeah.
What were you writing on, sir? I'd like to know.
Yeah, is he
on... like what show? Because this show kind of like, well, part of what I love about the aesthetic of this movie is like it could kind of happen basically whenever. Like they do that cool thing where there's not any dated tech really included in the story. So you can kind of project it to be whenever. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'm like, what? What if he was like, I'm a Seinfeld writer, and you're like, no, that canonically, what is he supposed to be writing? That's really interesting.
I was kind of thinking that.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Who knows?
Anyway, one night, Golly invites a date over, and it turns out to be the vegetable stealer guy. And they go out for dinner and a movie, and they're late getting back to Harriet's house. And when they return, Harriet's mom is super worried because she's like, "Where? I didn't know where Harriet was." So she fires Golly. But then, like, immediately takes it back. But even so, this all transpires to Golly deciding to leave. She's like, it's time for me to go. Harriet is grown up enough now. And I'm going to peace out.
Also, Harriet's mom was being very unreasonable in that situation.
Extremely.
Yes.
Like, this woman is raising your child for you. Can you chill?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, well, women be lashing out. So, yeah, you know.
Good thing she has her comedy writer husband to keep her in check. You're just like, what? Anyways, what up? Yes. Harriet's parents are weird.
Yeah, they are.
The whole thing is weird.
Yeah.
But Golly leaves, and her parting words to Harriet are, you know, keep being a spy and keep writing. So she does. She does her normal spy route with the cat guy and the Hong Fat market. And then she sees her friend, Sport, struggling to pay for groceries, and she pretends that he dropped a dollar outside so that she can, like, help pay for his groceries. And then she snoops around Eartha Kitt's house.
What a treat. Random. What a fun treat. Because you hear Eartha Kitt before you see her, and so I was just like, no way. Right. What? And then it's her, and it's just it's clear that she was on set for 5 hours mm-hmm. and then that you're just like, what a treat. So happy to see her.
Oh, yes. But it's at Eartha Kitt's house that Harriet gets caught, and good spies never get caught. So she's super down on herself for having been caught. So the next day, instead of doing her usual spy route, she decides to play with her friends. She's like, I don't deserve to be a spy. I'll do normal kid stuff. Mm. So during a game of bumper tag, Harriet drops her notebook, and her nemesis, Marion Hawthorne, picks it up and starts reading it to a group of kids. And it becomes clear that it's basically a burn book where Harriet is just saying pretty mean stuff about all of her classmates, including her best friends, Janie and Sport. So now that this is all out in the public, everyone hates her. And her friends ignore her, and the kids at school are like passing around notes saying that Harriet smells, and they build a clubhouse for catching spies. And
it's a cool clubhouse.
It is a cool clubhouse.
It's a really cool clubhouse.
I want that clubhouse.
Right?
They duct tape it together. It's built the way that kids would build a clubhouse, and I appreciated that.
Exactly. Yeah.
Then her parents are like, you're obsessed with being a spy and it's not healthy. And they make her give up her notebook. And then there's an incident at school where Marion and her friends dump blue paint on her. And she freaks out. She goes home. She rips her notebook up.
It's very Big Fat Liar, even though this movie came out before Big Fat Liar. I'm just like, oh, yeah, Paul Giamatti got blue painted, too. It happens.
Oh, yep. I haven't seen that
Why
movie.
Is that a children's movie trope?
Just getting dumped on by blue paint?
By blue paint.
Blue paint.
I don't know.
I'll write a think piece on it.
Yeah, please. And then Harriet decides to get revenge on her classmates for doing this. And she carves like a hit list into her desk. And
Very scary.
Wow.
She gets revenge by cutting off a girl's ponytail. She ruins various school projects. She tells Marion that her dad doesn't love her. Pretty traumatic things like that.
Very rebellious. That, yeah. Very rebellious.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Harriet's a flawed character.
It's true. We'll talk all about it.
And then there's little moments too where I love Harriet so much, but I'm like, oh yeah, she's also a rich brat, where sometimes she'll do things where I'm just like, oh, you just like have so much privilege you can't see.
She lives in an enormous apartment, really nice.
How
in the Upper East
that
Side
house worth like a budget. I mean
so much.
It boggles the mind. And it's also such a cool movie house.
It's rent controlled, you guys.
They pay $700 a month to live there.
She inherited it from her grandma's grandma. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's like Friends.
Right. Yeah. Right. So her parents are like, uh-oh, something's happening with our daughter. She's really lashing out. So they take her to a child psychologist. And this is when she's maybe starting to realize that what she was writing in her notebook was kind of nasty and it hurt people's feelings. So her parents give her notebook back and Golly comes back for a visit. And Golly is like, here's the thing. You need to apologize and you need to tell some white lies because white lies are okay. And also maybe try writing something other than notes in your notebook. So then Harriet goes to apologize to Janie and Sport. They're still sour at first. And then in class, Harriet suggests that people besides just the class president should get to write the school newspaper. Mm-hmm. So the kid with the purple socks is like, yeah, I agree. And Harriet is a really good writer. I nominate her to be the editor of the newspaper.
It's kind of incredible how much the kid in the purple socks ends up coming through and having narrative significance in the
right?
end. And you don't see it coming.
And this is someone who Harriet said should hang themselves. It's really
And he really
awful.
Gets over it.
This is the think piece I want.
Right. The kid with the purple socks went home and was like, you know what? Sticks and stones may break my bones, but good journalism is good journalism. and then he advocates for her.
He sure does. So everyone else is like, yeah, Harriet, you're the new editor of the newspaper. So then she writes a retraction, apologizing, saying the things that she had written before weren't fair. She was too quick to judge people and jump to conclusions. And then the movie ends with her class dancing around during their winter pageant.
Like in a gravy boat.
In a gravy boat. Yeah. Harriet is an onion, I think. The costumes are pretty fun.
It reminded me so much of... Does anyone remember that episode of Hey Arnold where there are fruits in the play?
Yes.
That's another like fun children's media trope. Like we got to dress up the kids like food. People love it.
1,000,000%.
It's so good.
And that's the story. So let's take a quick break and then we will come right back to discuss.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart's Outspoken Network for a year, and what a year it has been. Every weekday, I navigate our rapidly changing world alongside our series of fabulous expert guests. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Woke not just to the latest headlines, but also to the collective power we all have. Woke to the need to build community with those around us. Woke to how to avoid burnout and woke to the ways we can all find joy in the madness. Make Woke AF Daily with Danielle Moody your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. And tune in to hear the ways I am working to stay grounded amidst it all. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Started talking about this incident. Drugs and officials cover up. You couldn't believe it.
From iHeart Podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
There's no way that that guy's a doctor.
I'm Paul Pringle, and I'm an investigative reporter for the LA Times. This is the story of an investigation that starts in a hotel room in Pasadena, California, and reaches all the way to the top of two of the most powerful institutions in the city of Los Angeles.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
This is Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption.
We're always going to have predators. It's the good people who stand by and do nothing that allow them to flourish.
Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite in powerful conversations. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross.
Tiffany Cross.
I want you all to join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. In every episode, we gather a seasoned elder.
But even with a child, there's no such thing as the wrong thing if you love them.
Myself, as the middle generation,
I don't feel like I have to get married at this big age in life, but it is a desire I have and something that I've navigated in dating.
And a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations.
I'm very jealous of your generation that didn't have to deal with Instagram and Tinder.
This is Across Generations, where Black women's voices unite, and together, you know how we do, we create magic. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Where to begin with Harriet? I mean, should we just start by talking about Harriet?
I suppose so. I think
there's no better place.
The first thing I want to say, I think, is that because I didn't remember what the movie was about, like my 10-year-old brain just completely forgot. Mm-hmm. I assumed that this story was going to be kind of like a Nancy Drew type story where like Harriet would have to like solve a mystery because she's a spy and she comes across a thing that she needs to figure out.
Interesting.
But I think what happens in this movie is way more realistic to what an 11-year-old girl would get involved in, rather than like somehow being able to solve this like this mystery.
Right. Right.
So I thought that was actually really cool, because as I was watching it, I was like, when's the mystery going to happen? When are they going to establish that? And I'm like, oh, wait a minute. That's not what this movie is about.
It's about her. Yeah. I like that she like it. They make it clear that she's like devoted to what she does and she is good at it. But you're also like, but like, what is she doing? Which is how all of us when we were 11 did things. Like, we were just like, yeah, this is important and this is cool. And then at the end, they're like, well, what did you accomplish? And you're like, nothing. I got into a fight with my mom.
Right.
Harriet is such a cool, complicated character where I was really like kind of like really impressed with how this movie just like goes there with like parent conflict and the like subtleties of like communicating that Harriet's parents are like kind of have like failed her in some ways, mm-hmm. and that there has to be a conversation about how they have failed her in some ways and how they just don't really understand her. And there's like class stuff tackled in this movie where like Harriet doesn't clearly demonstrate through how she treats sport, like doesn't understand class really at all, mm-hmm. And like has to learn that, and she like fucks up but is still, I don't know, yeah, it like the movie tackles so many different things that are all like stuff that affects kids, but it does it in a way that is still appealing to kids. It's like, it's incredible.
Yeah, they do a good job, because it's Nickelodeon. I think it was one of the first movies that Nickelodeon had released, and I was reading about it because I think it's interesting that the book by Louise Fitzhugh has been banned.
Mm-hmm. It's on banned books list for different like school, like children's libraries and school libraries and things like that. Yeah,
I don't remember ever seeing it in a school library.
No.
Which is like...
Because it goes back to the thing of like, our, you know, the parents probably have this weird torrid relationship with the movie, because it's like the parents failing and they're not, you know, failing their child and not being there for her. But I like the idea of like the power of words, like teaching the kids what the power that they have with their, what they say and what they think and how they express it. Mm. I also was thinking about like Sweet Little Golly and her relationship. I love that relationship between the two ladies. But, you know, I was like, oh, this is how I'll be able to teach my kid about how to white lie and how that's okay. Mm-hmm. I was like, I'm going to take that.
Even, I mean, like that scene is such a cool, like big swing of like, I don't know, like just a, like that just shows how seriously the like writers of this movie take their kid audience of like, they don't doubt that that'll like,
right,
you know, resonate with them.
Yeah. I mean, I think like the whole way through with Harriet, like she is flawed. So I go back and forth. I'm like, am I supposed to be rooting for her this whole time? Or am I supposed to kind of, I'm learning things as a 34-year-old woman from Harriet. But you know, at the end of the day, like with that sweet scene at the end, it's like sometimes you have to lie, but to yourself, you must always tell the truth. Like, that's mm-hmm. it, you mm-hmm. know? So I think there were really, really great messages along the way for and nuggets for these kids to actually take, even though, you know, our 10-year-old brains were like, I want to be a spy, you know, and that's it. But like having these like non-conformist women at the helm of a film where you go like, oh, I, you know, the underrepresented is represented in a way.
Yeah. I love her relationship with Golly. I think her relationship with Golly is so beautiful and cool. And I feel like a really good model of like how adults can treat children not with kid gloves. And it can be like a very like that's just like how you should treat a kid generally. Mm-hmm. I love like that scene where Golly like listens to Harriet. She cares about her interests. She supports what Harriet's interested in. And then also like does that cool thing where like it's like an adult takes you seriously and then tries to like expand your knowledge, where she like brought her to see that movie about Mata Hari, and she knows about Josephine Baker and like all these female spies. Or I think like Golly is such a cool character, and the fact that we also get a little look into her personal life and her interior life, because I feel like in these movies that mostly hang out in like the upper crust class, the only poor characters you see have no interior life that we're made aware of. Mm-hmm. But it's like Golly has a life and she has interests and she advocates for herself when like Harriet's mom, you know, like treats her like shit. Right. She's like, no, I'm out of here. I don't need to put up with this.
I also love the femme fatale movie theater. Like, yeah. I was like, okay.
Ooh, it's great.
Yeah, because they went to like a femme fatale like film festival, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then they like saw, I think it was a real movie that was like based on like Mata Hari's adventures and... I don't know. These were like women that I like wrote a report on Mata Hari when I was a kid. Cause I'm like, oh, spies. Blah. Like, it's, yeah. Their relationship is great. And it made me cry when Golly left the first time.
It's really sweet.
She's like, maybe I'll travel. Like, yes.
I know. You're just like, all right.
I want to go with Golly.
Right? Some other things that I like that we've already touched on, but like, I guess in terms of Harriet's friend group. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you heard what Vanessa had to say, but the fact that, you know, Harriet's two friends are Janie, who is a woman of color in STEM. Mm-hmm. It's so rare to see little Black girls doing science on screen or having an interest in science in mm-hmm. any media. That was really remarkable. And
also doesn't like make a big, I feel like a big thing there is also just like normalizing it mm-hmm. and not making it this like big focal point. It's like, yeah, Janie likes science. This is what she does. This is how she acts, blah, blah, blah. And like, right. it just is.
She also has like a fascination with very destructive science. She's like, I love the H-bomb. I love a mushroom cloud. Yeah, Manhattan Project, let's do it. And we're like,
you're like, all right.
She's obsessed with laser beams that would like disintegrate people.
She'll work it out in therapy later.
Right.
All these kids are in therapy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Janie is awesome. And I was also kind of just based on other movies that we've covered and like tropes that we've noticed over the years. I think I'm thinking of The Craft, where normally, you know, in a movie where there's only one person of color and usually specifically a Black character, you don't get to see their home life or their home life is kind of excluded from the narrative. And that, again, is just like not the case for Janie. And it's done in a very like just a normalized way of like you see her mom's like, stop blowing things up. And you're like, all right, cool. There yeah. we are. You get a peek at the home life and like, I guess to be fair, not in the same amount of detail that we get for Harriet and for Sport. But you do get to see her home life, her relationship with her mom. And it's, you know, it's like a meaningful part of the story.
Mm-hmm. And then, I mean, speaking of Sport, I also like that the movie normalizes girls being friends with boys. Cause I think a lot of yeah. media targeted to children would try to emphasize a divide between girls and boys and like how, oh, girls can't
or turn it into like a crush narrative.
That too. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
But they're just, you know, platonic friends. There's no indication, at least in the movie, that any of them have any, you know, little crush on anyone else.
Yeah. No, they're busy.
They're too busy being spies and, you know, making spores in their bedroom and stuff like that. And then with Sport, there is, like you said, Jamie, some attention is drawn to class because, you know, Harriet comes from a well-to-do family, whereas Sport...
I mean, to say the least.
I mean, yeah.
Like, right. Is her dad Larry David? Like, how is a comedy writer having that house?
Right.
Who Madness. Knows? Yeah, Sport comes from a poor family who... His dad is also a writer, but, you know, there's that line where Harriet says something like, my dad would call guys like your dad a starving artist.
Get a real job.
Yeah, why won't Harriet's dad staff Sport's right? dad?
Right. If he's the showrunner of Seinfeld, give Sport's dad a job on the show.
I know, right?
Right, but, Louise. Like, what if he's a shitty writer?
That could be it. Well, he does sell something for $10,000 at the end, so
that's true.
That's something.
I like this sweet little scene where she climbs up and she's spying on Sport, and like she sees Sport with his dad, and they're running around like with you know, having this like grand old time with a chicken hat or whatever that thing was. But yeah, it I think it also shows that like happiness comes in different forms and being fulfilled in a different way for children to kind of understand that, like that you don't need money to have a happy family was also like pretty powerful, I thought.
For sure. I mean, there's definitely an existing trope where children from poor families or just poor families in general are miserable. Right. And often there's like this idea that like, oh, parents of a poor family are abusive or negligent or, you know, any manner of like really negative stereotypes. And we don't see that at all with Sport's family.
Right. Well, I will say just a little bit that like Sport, I guess I think that Sport's dad is kind of weirdly written in some moments of like he's not a good parent. He's not written to be a good parent because like Sport is the one who is like doing the cooking and like buying groceries because his dad is too depressed to write his shitty book. So I feel like it is not like entire like I don't know.
Yeah, fair point. That yeah.
I feel like I mean this movie and this story goes out of the way to give kids a lot of agency, but like Sport is seems to be running the house and he is, you know, 10 or 11.
Right.
That's fair.
I mean, which does mean we see a little boy doing a lot of like domestic chores, which we never see.
The context of it though, I don't know.
It doesn't like
is I don't I mean yeah it seems like he has you know a depressive parent but then it's like that thing where they're like well depressive equals art so best not to deal with it so I don't know I was a little concerned for Sport even when things started working out for the family because I'm just like are we does Sport still have to cook tonight like can this dad learn how to make a box of mac and cheese for his son please
right
I was just worried about Sport.
There is an exchange of dialogue that I thought was really powerful and I think would have been especially powerful to see if I had remembered it as a child when I saw it. But, you know, Harriet says something like, I hate money. And Sport replies with, you'd like it a lot more if you didn't have any.
Right.
Which is such a, like, you know, Harriet's coming from this really privileged place. So, of course, like, she gets to hate money because money doesn't, a lack of money isn't affecting her. Like she doesn't have to worry about that.
Right. She's never had to. Yeah. She's never had to like really think about it. One of the things where I feel, okay, so Harriet, I like that that there is some like class diversity in this movie as well. And one of the, I think cool things that Harriet does as a little rich New York kid, is that she gets to go to therapy. And I was kind of like, when this scene came up, I was like, oh, you know, it's like 96. You don't really know which way this is going to go. Because I feel like, especially during this time, there is still like significant stigma against any kind of therapy. And you would sometimes see therapy characters made out to be kind of like kooky and like kind of like snake oil salesmen. And, you know, they're like, how are you feeling? And they don't actually understand. They're not actually listening. But I really love the direction that this movie takes it, which is that it is helpful for Harriet. Like, and the fact that she went to therapy, even though she herself was skeptical of it, ends up improving her parents' understanding of her more so than her understanding of herself. But I was happy to see that therapy and like mental health stuff was not made a joke of, because I feel like that's an easy joke that you kind of see a lot in movies in the like 90s, early 2000s.
True.
Yeah. I think you still have a long way to go with therapy still and mental health, even though we're moving in a forward motion. But we're watching Sopranos for the first time right now, where I think they're doing a really wonderful job with the way in that world, like, you know, handling and approaching the topic of mental health. But like they bring their son to, you know, their son's not paying attention, they think he has ADD, he's gonna get tested. It's like I want to see people go who don't have major overlaying issues, meaning that like you have to go to therapy just because of that. Like we always see kids being brought to therapy because they're troubled rather than just being able to say like therapy's okay for everybody.
Mm-hmm. True.
You know,
and it's ultimately in this case, it seems like Harriet is being part of the reason Harriet is being sent to therapy is because her parents are not doing the work they need to do to understand, like,
right.
It's just as much of them. Like they should also be in therapy. And I hope that they are.
Right.
Well, the movie kind of frames it that Golly leaving is the catalyst for
good trauma. Yeah.
Yeah. It's Harriet's trauma and it's why she sort of lashes out. And because like what happens is that people find her notebook where she has said all these, you know, perhaps truthful but still mean things about all of her classmates.
Yeah.
And then they retaliate against her because they're like, you can't say this horrible stuff about us. That's mean. And they kind of shun her. But she retaliates against them again for having been shunned.
She really doubles down.
She doubles down. And it's like, but like, that's also a realistic thing that I think a lot of 11-year-olds would do.
I honestly, watching this, I'm like, anytime I see a movie where kids like kind of act out in a funny way, I'm like, oh, I wish I was like a bolder child and I like recognized at the time that I'm like, this really isn't going to have that much of an effect on my life. I should just do some fucked up weird stuff. She really doubles down in a way I would not have been brave enough to attempt as an 11-year-old. It's inspiring.
Yeah. Because I think maybe a movie that had a lesser understanding of like children's behavior and psychology would just have it so that her book got found, all of her, you know, mean notes were revealed, and then she would just be like, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry, everyone.
Right.
Better now? But like, no.
But that's not Harriet.
It spirals out of control. And I could like totally see myself, like me, I don't think I ever did anything quite like that. But like, you know, when you're a kid and you don't know how to hold yourself accountable for any misdeeds you did.
Right.
You're going to keep lashing out because you just don't know how else to process anything.
Right.
I had a really embarrassing thing, like it wasn't a mean thing, but when I was in fifth grade, I left an open document at the computer lab saying that I was like trying to I don't know. Anyways, my teacher was Mr. Brewster and I had typed the words Mr. Brewster hot and it became a thing that was, you know, it was not an easy time to have been the girl that typed Mr. Brewster hot. Because I meant it as a question, not as a statement, not that anyone would believe me. I meant Mr. Brewster hot. But the punctuation wasn't there. And so and I just doubled down in saying that it was a question and not a statement, which made the whole thing worse. And being a child is a full-fledged nightmare.
It's traumatic.
It's so true.
I think about it all, like even thinking about it now just still puts a pit in my stomach. Ugh, of like,
don't you
damn,
hate that?
Should have just pressed backspace. Like it would have been so easy.
That's basically the plot of Love, Simon, by the way.
Yes, I was, it's actually based on me and Mr. Brewster's story. They licensed it from us.
Wow, incredible.
Yeah.
Let's take a quick break and then we'll come back for more discussion.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart's Outspoken Network for a year, and what a year it has been. Every weekday, I navigate our rapidly changing world alongside our series of fabulous expert guests. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Woke not just to the latest headlines, but also to the collective power we all have. Woke to the need to build community with those around us. Woke to how to avoid burnout, and woke to the ways we can all find joy in the madness. Make Woke AF Daily with Danielle Moody your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. And tune in to hear the ways I am working to stay grounded amidst it all. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite in powerful conversations. I'm your host,
Tiffany Cross. Tiffany Cross. I want you all to join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. In every episode, we gather a seasoned elder.
But even with a child, there's no such thing as the wrong thing if you love them.
Myself, as the middle generation, I don't feel like I have to get married at this big age in life, but it is a desire I have and something that I've navigated in dating. And a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations.
I'm very jealous of your generation that didn't have to deal with Instagram and Tinder.
This is Across Generations, where Black women's voices unite, and together, you know how we do, we create magic. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We started talking about this incident. Drugs and officials cover up. You couldn't believe it.
From iHeart Podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now? Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
There's no way that that guy's a doctor.
I'm Paul Pringle, and I'm an investigative reporter for the LA Times. This is the story of an investigation that starts in a hotel room in Pasadena, California, and reaches all the way to the top of two of the most powerful institutions in the city of Los Angeles.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
This is Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption.
We're always going to have predators. It's the good people who stand by and do nothing that allow them to flourish.
Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back.
There are some, as well as this movie does at exploring the intricacies of what it's like to be an 11-year-old girl with abundant resources and parents who don't seem to be able to keep track of where their daughter is most of the time because she's off doing spy stuff.
And a New York, a version of New York that is very safe.
Very safe and quite white.
Yes.
Which brings me to some of the issues that the movie has. So one of her spy targets is the Hong Fat family. And she says something like, oh, they have a son, Frankie. He's cool, American style. And then the parents are cool, Chinese style. And then she like makes a comment about how the parents would rather have Frankie working in the store selling milk and bread and lizards. Ugh. So it's this joke made at the expense of like this immigrant family and like, ooh, this thing they do that's unfamiliar to me.
Right.
It must be gross or it's weird. It's other.
Does not age well.
No.
Especially because it's like there's no, I mean, that's the end of, there's no commentary. Mm-mm. Like, it's just like, there are so many things. And it sucks because I wanted to believe better of this movie. Of there are so many things in this movie that Harriet is wrong about. And then she learns that she's wrong and gets some perspective on it. And you would think that this would be a great opportunity for you to be like, no, you're like a rich little white girl. You don't know what you're talking about here. Like, but it just, it never comes for this storyline.
No, it doesn't.
Unfortunately not.
Does it not.
I was also kind of bummed that I don't even, they give this character a name, but Marion's, I guess, like sidekick.
Yes, her name is Rachel.
Yeah, I don't love how that character is treated as one of like the only like non-white students that we get to know, and that she's kind of like relegated to this sidekick role.
Yeah.
And I also felt, I mean, Marion's character in general, I don't know how, well, I guess I don't know how I feel.
There's another weird class thing happening here. Because we've got Sport, who is very clearly from a low-income family. We've got Harriet, who is rich. But then Marion is even richer.
And so she's the villain? It's like, it's, And that, like, I don't know. I know that, like, rich people technically have feelings that we're supposed to, like, really care about it. But it was just that whole storyline. I was just like, what is this? Like, what?
Because it's like,
I don't want to it's just like a rich girl being mean to another rich girl and then right. being like, actually, I should have thought more about the richer girl. And you're just like, I don't know how to care about any of this.
Because it's like demonizing extra extreme excessive wealth in Marion, because they like have her say these really goofy things like, oh, horseback riding, if you can afford it, is a super fun activity. And then her idea for like a fun game that all the children can play is, let's role play buying a Volvo. You'll pretend to be the rich couple and you'll pretend to be the car salesman. And everyone's like, boo, you're an idiot.
So it's everyone like kind of hates her. Like
they love to hate her.
But then it's like, Harriet, you're also rich. Like, what do you like?
Right.
She's, I guess, slightly less rich than Marion. So Harriet's like cool by everyone else. I don't know. Like,
I ended up just kind of shrugging because I'm just like, I guess that to an extent, we're supposed to like just be like, we love Harriet no matter what. But it's like, yeah, Harriet, like, check yourself a little bit here. You're like, you're a 3%er and Marion's a 1%er. What's the fucking difference? Everyone relax.
Also, during that scene where like all the children are pitching games that they might play, someone says something and then Harriet says, no, that's R word. She says the R word.
Yeah.
Which, again, a very 90s thing to do. Even a very, like, 2000s, to some degree, 2010s thing to, like, that word was being used very casually.
It's still kicked around to this day to our infinite frustration.
Yeah.
I like jumped. I was like, no, no, there's 1996. How did you get here? How'd you get in here? Right.
Can we talk about the queer reading of this story?
Please.
So I have been known to do a little context corner myself every once in a while. Okay. Not to step on your toes, Jamie. I know, I'm so sorry.
Don't worry. Don't worry.
But I was doing some reading. And full disclosure, I have not read the book that this is adapted from.
It was banned.
We couldn't read it. It was banned. So the author, Louise Fitzhugh, was a queer woman. The book has a pretty substantial queer following. And I think it has a lot to do with the way Harriet was described in the book and just various actions and behaviors of hers throughout the story. Mm-hmm. I wanted to read an excerpt from an article that I found from The Guardian entitled Harriet the Spy Helped Me Come to Terms with My Queer Identity by Kat Patrick. Quote, Harriet the Spy blurred the lines between right and wrong in a way that liberated my 9-year-old brain. As a kid who already felt left out by the mechanisms of femininity that everyone around me seemed to adopt with ease, Harriet was the blue denim baby butch I needed among the endless ballerina narratives. Back then, I didn't have the words for what I felt fizzing through my inside, and even now, 15 years after coming out, I'm only just learning to feel comfortable with how I present, non-binary butch. End quote. I recommend reading this entire article because the writer goes on to offer a queer reading on Harriet's spy route, the idea of having to tell, you know, little white lies to survive, but also remaining true to yourself. All of these themes that are explored. Queer listeners, let us know how the movie resonated with you and the book, if you've read it.
If you could get your hands on one.
If you can even get your hands on it.
As far as the movie goes, and we always like want to know more about what our queer listeners think and what your read is. But I think that like a strength of the movie is that it doesn't force heterosexuality on its child characters. Like they're just being kids. There aren't like those constructs aren't, there's no external pressure for that really coming from any direction, which is very, I was like so refreshed by it that I'm like, wow, this really does happen in every other kid's movie. Cause it just like creates so much room in the story for interpretation and just doing other things by not taking up too much real estate with like boy girl crushes, which is also just boring and bad writing.
Yes.
I have some context stuff on the production of this movie. I pretty much love all of it. So this was directed by a woman, a pretty young woman as well. I think she was like 28 or 29 when she directed the movie. It was her first big production. Her name's Bronwyn Hughes. Mm-hmm. Everything I've read about her, I love. She still is directing mostly like prestige TV now. She directed a Better Call Saul episode this year. Like, she's out here. Mm-hmm. But this was her first movie, and I just was like really interested in how she was able to direct kids in a way that feels so organic, because Caitlin and I have like joked around before of like the way that some child actors are directed, it just does them no favors, and the way that some child characters are written does them no favors, but like Harriet the Spy feels like this big outlier. And so I wanted to learn more about her direction style, and everything I read about her was that they were just like, she just had like the highest energy, and she was like dancing with the kids all day, and so like takes would happen right after like Michelle Trachtenberg was like dancing around, and then Bronwyn Hughes would be like, okay, now go, and that would like bring the energy into the scene.
Wow.
So here's a quote from Michelle Trachtenberg about it. She says, I don't remember her not dancing on set, and music was always playing. It was really cool, and in terms of performance art, she was pretty ahead of her time. It was also a great way to direct children and keep things alive. And so I don't know. I ended up finding a new director that I really want to see like more of her work, just based off of. And even like the pacing of it has like such a cool, like jazzy kind of pacing. And some of the shots, you're like, oh, this is like kind of like art school for a kid's movie. I like it.
Right?
Totally. Yeah, that just the colors and like the tone of the whole thing is like, it's a, like a little quirky, but yet still like a little gritty at the same time. Like has that New York grit to it. And I agree. I just wanted to know more about her because I thought she did like a fabulous job, and it's really hard to direct kids. I mean, I'll tell you, like when I was a kid, they would always just like, there would be really good directors and really bad directors. And I recently had to direct a child, and he's a bit younger, so that was even harder. But like, it's a big, mighty task to take on.
Yeah, and she just like kills it. And
brilliant.
And you have to imagine that having a female director on this movie made a big difference too. And just like, how do we see the kids? And so there's also two credited writers on this movie. One is a man named Douglas Petrie, who has done a ton of mostly TV writing, but on shows with a pretty good reputation for representing women. He was like a staff writer on Buffy the Vampire Slayer forever. Ooh. He wrote on Angel. He's written a lot of well-regarded female comic book characters. I don't know shit about comic books. Don't at me. And then the other writer is Teresa Rebeck, who is famous for, she's like a legendary female mystery writer, and is known for writing like mysteries that have like a feminist character at the center. So it seems like they just really brought together a really solid team of majority women to make this movie happen. And it feels like a great example of like a great product that you can get if you just kind of get at least some of the right people in the room.
I wonder how passionate they were in finding the director and finding Bronwyn, like how passionate they were about finding a female director for this film, because I think it could have been a completely different film without a female director.
Totally.
And a female perspective. And like, you know, nowadays it's a requirement for a lot of films. And so I would just be curious in that time, you know, how much of a stickler they were for it, or if she was just the right, you know, pick.
Like who was pushing for it. Right. It's interesting because I feel like, especially in this era, like Nickelodeon has kind of a better track record with how its female characters are written and treated than, if you're going pound for pound against Disney, which, you know, their history with women is maybe not so great. I was also kind of surprised that this movie was not particularly well reviewed.
It was not.
At the time. And a lot of this I will chalk up to, especially in the 90s, older white male film critics being like, I didn't see any, this wasn't for me. And then just kind of being like, see ya. But yeah, it seems like it was a movie that was misjudged in its time as well, which was just, I guess, kind of strange to me because I've truly never heard a bad word about this movie before going back to the original reviews. Mm-hmm. And I disagree with all of them. They're like, where's the mystery? Like, they're... She didn't even solve a mystery. I'm pissed.
Oh, no. I had that same thought. Am I bad?
You're double canceled.
Double canceled.
But in any case, it's definitely, I think, a movie that's reputation has really, like, solidified over time. Apparently, it didn't in the moment.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it has to be a bit of a cult following, right? Yeah. Like, a little bit. And I think tonally... Those weird, you know, that art feel that I think you mentioned earlier. It's like some people get it and some people don't. And the tone of this is really quirky, a little off kilter. And I feel like if you're not the blockbuster that they're looking for or the mainstream, it's not going to be well reviewed. But other people will get it.
Yeah, I feel like the intended audience of this movie got it.
Yeah.
And like it wasn't written for old guys, and so they perhaps did not get it. Right. I also wanted to mention, just because I'm like, this is interesting, Teresa Rebeck, she wrote the screenplay for the Halle Berry Catwoman movie.
Oh,
and you're like, wow. Oh my
cinematic
goodness.
Masterpiece, Catwoman.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, people contain multitudes.
They sure do. I wanted to touch a little bit on some of the adults in the movie.
Yeah.
One, I appreciate that the teacher was not villainized the way that a lot of kids' movies will villainize educators.
Sure.
She was maybe made to seem a little oblivious, perhaps, but she wasn't this, like, mean, authoritarian teacher the way that a lot of, again, like, kids' movies will be like, teacher, bad. Mm-hmm. And I understand.
Well, yeah, that from, like, the kids' perspective.
From a kid's perspective,
like,
sure.
Teachers suck. Or sometimes they're hot. Something to consider.
Hot question mark or not question mark.
The teacher also magically disappears after cleaning up Harriet with the blue paint, which also gave me a slight panic attack. I was like, yes. Everybody get off of her. She just disappears.
Yeah.
She's like, let's clean Harriet up. And then, you know, Marion's like, spill. And then no teacher.
Where is
goodbye.
She? Where's the discipline? But yeah, that was just a quick little thing I had. And then another quick, very quick moment in the movie, but I appreciated this. It's after Harriet has tormented her entire class and cut their hair off and strung a bra up on the flagpole and like all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
She is at home and her parents come in and they are trying to figure out, like, what's happening? Why did she do this? And her dad comes in and he says something like, I used to mess around in school too. He's like trying to make light of the situation. And then her mom says something like, you always do that. You always make jokes. And then I have to come in here and be the grumpy one, which, like, it's not what this movie is about at all. It's like this tiny little moment that you would probably blank and you miss it kind of thing. But I just appreciate that small attempt to show that it is in a, like, mother father household, it is often the mother who has to bear the kind of emotional burden and the emotional labor of, like, being the disciplinarian, whereas the dad gets to be like, oh, I'm goofy, I'm fun, I don't know how to discipline my kids, it's not my job. I think we talked about this a lot in the Mrs. Doubtfire episode.
That's also true of, I mean, every family show I remember watching as a kid was like, you know, shrewy mom that occasionally has a scene that's like, but I love you, and then, like, goofy dad.
Right.
It's canon. I remember my dad used to get really mad about it. He's just like, I mean, it's not really a fair of, like, who cares, but he was just like, not all dads are stupid. I'm like, Yeah. Okay. Right. I'm sorry. How does it feel to be negatively portrayed in media, Dad?
Yeah. I just the mom acknowledging that and like acknowledging that frustration of like, you get to be the fun one and I have to come in here and be the grumpy one. Like, I found that just to be a little sliver of something I enjoyed.
Just a nugget. Just I'll leave it there.
Yeah.
And I liked that you do get a scene with Harriet and her mother where like Harriet, I mean, we as an audience already know that Harriet's parents are very flawed parents that don't really understand their child because they haven't spent time with her and listened to her. Like, if they had spent the same kind of time that Golly had, they would have a better understanding of her. And I mean, it's just like another shade of gray that this movie shows you with like how kids relate to people in their lives that I thought was really nice, of like her mother admitting that she was wrong and that she doesn't always understand her daughter, and that like that can be true and she can be trying to be better. And you know, you hope that moving forward that like, I don't know, it's nice that Harriet got, because Harriet does like deserve an apology for how her parents treat her. Mm-hmm. And it would have been nice for it to come from both parents, but I did like that mother-daughter scene where you, even though I'm like, this mom needs to get it together, you're also like, well, okay, she acknowledges that she, you know, has work to do and that both parents have work to do. And I thought it was handled, you know, pretty well.
Yeah,
for sure. There's another one last little thing is the movie, and this is like hardly anything, but there are two different scenes in the movie where the kids are watching like, you're developing bodies, going through puberty, this is how it's gonna be.
Like old, really old videos too.
Right.
You're
so
like,
old.
What year is this?
They're like from the 60s or something.
Yeah.
Right. And then like the fact that Harriet pretty much body shames one of her classmates for like having grown boobs over the summer is again not something that we admire or recommend children do, but it is again just such a realistic thing, because like, you know, as young kids their bodies are changing, they're going through puberty, they don't know what's happening, if they see someone else going through puberty first, they think it's weird and gross, and like,
right.
Again, basically everything that Harriet does and her thoughts, well, some of them are like pretty violent and I don't condone at all, like the kid with the purple socks should hang himself, that other girl, someone should just kick her, like those obviously are not okay and there's no justification for them, but other ones I'm just like, of course you think that, because that's such an 11-year-old understanding of bodies or of like socioeconomic class and, you know, just different things like that. So while some of them were quite troubling and violent, other ones I'm like, I mean, I don't like that she said this, but I understand because it's super realistic.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Sigh.
It's like, it's complicated.
It is.
It's complicated with Harriet the Spy.
You know why? That just speaks to like, it's so refreshing to see like a complicated depiction of a little girl, of any female character. I mean, we like, female characters are so often written to be so flat and stock and stereotypical that it is nice to, I mean, we talk about like women should be allowed to be mediocre in movies. Women should be allowed to like fuck up and make mistakes. And like, that's really most of what Harriet is doing, is like having to learn major life lessons, having to apologize for various misdeeds, things like that. And I think it's actually very refreshing to get to see like a little girl go through that arc.
It's true. Mm-hmm. This movie is fun.
Yeah, kudos to the, you know, like Nickelodeon for, because they're saying like age 9 is like the common sense age. And like most would be too pure, you know, and not allow any of these issues to really come to the forefront of the film. Mm-hmm. So like,
yeah, it's very hard to imagine like Disney in 1996 taking a female protagonist this seriously. So I'm glad that Harriet was out there for us. Mm-hmm.
Does anyone else have any final thoughts about the film?
I don't think so.
The last thing I want to say is, feminist icon Agatha K. Plummer, aka Eartha Kitt's character, who we only
see. Was
she
supposed to be like Agatha Christie? I'm not sure. I was like, is this an Agatha Christie reference? What is Eartha Kitt doing in there?
Don't know, but one of the few lines of dialogue she has is she's talking on the phone with someone and she says, "I have the secret of life. You simply crawl into your bed and never ever leave it again," which in the quarantine is something that I have been doing. So thank you.
Aspirational.
For that, Agatha K. Yeah. Plummer.
Agatha K. I'm just like, I feel like it's an, because especially because it's like a female mystery story. I'm like, this has to be some weird Agatha Christie, at least reference.
I'm guessing.
yeah. Maybe.
Don't know.
Shrug. Does Harriet the Spy pass the Bechdel test by any chance?
Yes.
Yeah, all the time.
Woo. It rocks.
Lots of different combinations of characters. Harriet talks to Golly, to Janie, to her mom, to her teacher, to Marion. Yeah, lots of different combinations of characters. And they're not talking about boys or men hardly ever.
And there's also non-Harriet combos, too. Like, Janie talks to her mom, and Marion talks to Rachel. And there's a lot of good... This handily passes the test.
Absolutely. Let's rate it on our nipple scale, 0 to 5 nipples, based on its representation of women. I would give this, I think, like a 4. I'll take some points off for the very 90s punching down humor and language that we see here and there, especially because I read that in the book it's an Italian family that she spies on. It's the DeSanti family. So the adaptation deliberately changed it to the Hong Fat family, and then made Harriet be kind of racist. So, you know.
You don't get a nipple for that.
You don't get nipple for that. Also, just like, I mean, even though the movie does address class, it is still like, and here's this, you know, wealthy white girl and her story, because that's the story that, you know, we feel needs to be told more than other people's stories. So, you know, not a perfect film or story, but I do think it...
But much closer than most movies we've covered.
For sure. So I'll give it 4 nipples. I'll give... 1 to Janie. I'll give 1 to Janie the character, and I'll give 1 to Vanessa Chester. Thanks again so much to her for chatting with us and giving her input. I will give 1 to your voice, Jenna, that is present in the playgrounds or the, you know, the various scenes. And I'll give 1 to Harriet. No, actually, I'm going to give my 4th nipple to Eartha Kitt and her just yes, wanting to stay in bed for the rest of her life. Can relate.
Yeah, I'm going to go with 4 nipples on this, too. I think for 1996, this movie does very well, but it still has, I mean, as we discussed, it has its shortcomings, it has its datedness, and it has, as most children's media, a fixation on a rich white family above any other family. Mm-hmm. It loses the nipple for that. But in terms of creating a fleshed out, not hypersexualized female character that makes mistakes, that learns from those mistakes, maybe not as many mistakes as we would have liked, but more than I expected, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just like has a full life and is allowed to fuck up and learn and have interests that are not hyper feminine and eat mayonnaise sandwiches and shit. Like, it's all great. and I do generally, I like the small class commentary. I mean, you know, probably could go a little further, but it's a great movie. I really like it. I feel like it super holds up in most ways. So I'll give 1 nipple to Jenna's omniscient voice. I'll give 1 nipple to Michelle Trachtenberg, 1 to Vanessa Chester, and I'll complete Eartha Kitt's set. Give her another nip.
Incredible. Yeah. Jenna, what about you?
Yeah, I would give it 4 nipples. 1 nipple definitely does not get given any attention. Yeah, for, you know, the little, I don't want to call them slip-ups, but the shortcomings with the you know, socioeconomic class, and this young girl of really who has quite a lot of privilege. Mm-hmm. But I do want to say, like, I give the four for the representation for kids and females, to be specific, young girls who, like Harriet, have sort of found their purpose in the world, mm-hmm. in a way, yeah. like as a writer, and is just trying to figure out where it fits in the world. And to have a kid who has purpose, I think that's why we, you know, as kids related to her, at least I did as a young girl who had a purpose to, or I wanted her purpose in that moment in time. Mm-hmm. And I think that was not, and still is not, represented enough in media. So I definitely give the nipples to Rosie, to Jake Cameron, to Michelle, and to Vanessa.
Awesome.
Amazing.
Jenna, thank you so much for being here, for joining us today.
This is a blast.
Thanks for having me. It's so much fun to break down Harriet the Spy.
Absolutely. What would you like to plug?
Yeah, I'm mainly on Instagram at Jenna Ushkowitz, and my last name is spelled Ushkowitz. Yeah, I have a podcast called Showmance. It's a Glee recap podcast. You can find it wherever you find podcasts, on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Podcast One. And yeah, that's pretty much it.
Awesome. I didn't mention before, but I am a Glee stan.
Woo!
I have seen all of Glee, and I love it.
All of it.
I think
you were the one. How many viewer.
How many seasons were there?
6.
Oh yeah, I lied. I think I only made it to 5. I'm so sorry.
So you were part of the problem. That's pretty good. No. That was pretty good.
Thank you.
It started long before that. Oh, that's awesome. Thank you so much.
Oh, of course. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Bechdelcast. Mm-hmm. You can subscribe to our Patreon, aka Matreon, by going to patreon.com/Bechdelcast and subscribing for $5 a month.
You get 2 bonus episodes.
Yeah.
It's a good deal.
Plus our entire back catalog of bonus episodes.
Hefty. You can get our merch at teepublic.com/TheBechdelcast if you feel like wearing stuff. And thank you for listening.
Oh, and thanks again to Vanessa Chester for taking the time to talk to us.
Yeah.
Be sure to follow her on social media and go back and listen to our episode with her on the movie Booksmart.
She's the best.
Yeah, and with that,
with social distancing.
That's kind of what spying is.
It's true.
It's just true. Observing people at a distance.
So, spying is hot right now. Harriet. The original social distancer.
That's right. All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars for the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts. But we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart for a year, and what a year it has been. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Make Woke AF Daily your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.